Okay, well, good afternoon and welcome to this presentation of the interim financial result for Infigen Energy for the 6 months ended 31 December 2009. My name is Miles George. I'm the Managing Director of Infigen. Joining me today up here on the podium, Gerard Dover, our Chief Financial Officer, and Jeff Tutelis, our Chief Operating Officer. The agenda for this presentation is set out on slide two for those who are on the phone. I'll present a brief summary, followed by Gerard and Jeff, who will outline key elements of the financial and operating performance of the business during the period. I'll conclude the presentation with a brief summary of priorities and outlook, and then we'll open the floor and over the phone for questions. So turning to slide three, increased production from new and existing wind farms in Australia and Europe offset lower US production in the period, resulting in generation for the entire group being in line with the previous corresponding period. The Capital Wind Farm has performed in line with expectations, and the Lake Bonnie Stage 2 turbines were returned to full operational status in December. More recently, we appointed senior managers to lead the development, generation and newly established energy market business units. We've maintained a strong balance sheet position with cash balances of $214 million. Our sale processes remain on track for conclusion, with each process now in the final binding bid phase, and we're making good progress with our development pipeline back here in Australia. We're continuing discussions with government to restore the effectiveness of the Renewable Energy Target Scheme. The primary national interest objective of this scheme is to generate 20% of Australia's electricity from renewable resources by 2020, at least cost. However, the preferential treatment of small-scale technologies, domestic solar hot water, heat pumps and rooftop solar PV, under a range of generous federal and state incentives and special tariffs, in addition to the so-called multiplier and acceleration benefits that they receive under the RET scheme, is displacing much more efficient utility-scale renewable energy investments that can deliver the same level of emissions abatement and electricity at much lower cost. Clearly, the RET scheme is not working as intended, and although this has been acknowledged by the government in establishing a COAG review, urgent action is now required to restore the effectiveness of the RET scheme to deliver on its primary objective. Now turning to slide four. Revenue was up 4% on a constant currency basis, but EBITDA was down, reflecting lower merchant prices in the US, the retention of some Australian renewable energy certificates, and the operating costs of the Blue Arc asset management business that we acquired last year in the US. Corporate costs were down substantially on the prior corresponding period, and the net loss was greatly reduced, reflecting a substantial reduction in non-recurring items. Net debt and gearing remain comfortable, and financial flexibility is retained with a $214 million cash balance at the period end. Turning to slide five, average tariffs were maintained across the portfolio, while the capacity factor was affected by low wind conditions in the US and gearbox replacements at Lake Bonnie Stage 2, as previously noted, as well as the ramp-up of new assets. I'll now hand over to Gerard Dover to present the detailed financials.
Thanks, Miles. Slide 7 provides the key financial metrics for the first half. As described in our recent first half production report, production was flat compared to the prior corresponding period. Revenues grew by 4% on a constant currency basis compared to the prior period. EBITDA was lower. Underlying profit and net profit showed significant improvement. Net operating cash flow was 2.7 cents per security and reflects the lower first half seasonal profile observed in prior periods. Capital expenditure of $114.7 million represents continued investment in our Australian business and compares to $179 million invested in Australia in the prior corresponding period. Net debt and gearing has remained relatively unchanged during the period. Slide 8 is a summary of the profit and loss. As I mentioned, this shows a significant improvement in the bottom line. This is mainly as a result of lower financing costs, a net contribution from US tax equity, and a much lower level of non-recurring costs, which mainly related to the cost of separation from B&B. In the appendix on slide 30, we provide a much more detailed breakdown of the P&L. This itemises the components of the net financing costs, which have been positively impacted by the appreciation of the Australian dollar, as well as our high degree of interest rate hedging in a rising interest rate environment. Similarly, we provide the components of US tax equity income and expenditure, which in this period is a net contribution due to the falling tax equity balance and the reduction in value of the residual minority interest held by the tax equity providers. In effect, this partially offsets the lower operating EBITDA from US wind farms caused by low wind conditions this period. As in prior years, we would expect underlying performance to be stronger in the second half due to seasonality, new assets and continued operational improvements. This is reflected in our second half and full year guidance for revenue that I will describe later. Slide 9 provides a simple analysis of the movement in revenues from first half 09 to first half 10. The first item of difference is the decision to continue to retain RECs by Lake Bonney 2, generated by Lake Bonney 2. Given Infigen's financial flexibility and with REC prices still weak, we decided last year to hold these RECs on the balance sheet instead of selling them into the market. In the first half of FY09, the RECs from Lake Bonney 2 contributed $8 million of revenue. As at December 2009, Infigen held approximately 250,000 RECs on its balance sheet. RECs generated by other operating wind farms in Australia are contracted with off-takers at fixed prices, and this represented approximately $15.9 million of our revenue in the first half of FY10. Adverse production and tariff variances were $1.2 million and $5.4 million respectively. The production variance includes the impact of historically low wind conditions experienced in the US, significantly offset by improved performance of the European and Australian assets and compensation revenue under availability warranties. Jeff will elaborate with more detail during his presentation of the first half operational performance. The price variance results from lower merchant electricity prices experienced by our three uncontracted wind farms in the US and reflects the fall in US gas prices in the wake of the global financial crisis. Period-on-period prices in Australia have remained stable. The contribution of $20.7 million from new assets is broken down by country on the slide. As expected, the renewed strength of the Aussie dollar during the period reduced reported revenues by $13.8 million. Slide 10 is a simplified breakdown of operating costs to leave a total EBITDA from operations of $94.6 million or $88 million excluding US minority interests. The EBITDA margins by country are shown on the slide, and a reminder that US revenue and EBITDA does not include the contribution from production tax credits, which we recognise in other income and as an offset to the cost of tax equity. Inclusive of PDCs, the first half EBITDA margin for the US would have been 68%. Operating costs are higher than the corresponding period due to the increase in installed capacity as well as the inclusion of the cost base of our US asset management business, Blue Arc. Corporate costs were $10.4 million, which is $6 million lower than the corresponding period, including B&B base fees, and also lower than the budgeted run rate of $12 million, given our original guidance of $24 million for the year. We expect to retain at least $1 million of the savings compared to the original guidance for the full year. Slide 11 provides a summary of the cash flow statement reconciling opening to closing cash. Net operating cash flow of $21.5 million is analysed in more detail within the appendices, with the main components being $77.6 million of EBITDA offset by $46.9 million of net financing costs paid during the first half. Growth capex in the half totaled $114.7 million, which includes $46.6 million spent on Lake Bonney 3 and Capital Wind Farms, The balance of $68.1 million includes the purchase of 42 megawatts of Suzlon turbines destined for one of our near-term Australian developments. Also, development rights, including those purchased from B&B and the 20% minority interest at Caprock Wind Farm in the US. In the early part of the period, Infragen continued its buyback and purchased a further 5.7 million securities at a cost of 6.3 million, representing an average price of around $1.10. This brings the total securities bought back to 74.5 million securities at an average price of 90 cents. Non-recurring cash items in the cash flow includes $3.1 million of costs incurred in the overseas sales processes, as well as $10.7 million spent on contingent FX hedging for potential overseas disposal proceeds. Slide 12 shows a summary of the period-end balance sheet with a breakdown of key line items. This includes the $8 million of RECs held on the balance sheet, FX derivatives with a positive value of $17 million, and interest rate derivatives, which represent a liability of $100 million. We've also summarised Invergen's $2.9 billion enterprise value, which is made up of $1.3 billion of net debt, US tax equity, and $1.1 billion of equity. Debt ratios and covenants remain comfortable, although the poor US performance, retention of RECs, and timing mismatch between debt service and commencement of earnings from new plant in Australia means that ratios are slightly weaker than at June 2009. Our auditors agree with the assessment that no impairments are necessary. Significant financial flexibility is still evident, with over $200 million of cash and no unfunded commitments. There are no off-balance sheet liabilities. Interest costs remain significantly hedged, with an average interest rate of 6.3% during the period. Our global debt facility remains in place, with significant embedded value reflected by the continued low margin of 92 basis points. There is no refinancing deadline associated with the facilities, being fully amortising over the next 12 years. On slide 13, we have repeated the generation estimate for second half production that was included in our production and revenue report 2 weeks ago. We have also provided a revenue range for the second half to provide full year guidance by country. As can be seen in the graphical summaries, we expect the second half performance to be stronger than the first, driven largely by Australia and the US. And for Australia, we are confident that revenues will be 25 to 40% higher in the second half, resulting in growth of approximately 30% year-on-year domestically. I'll now hand you over to Jeff, who will run through the first half operations in more detail. Jeff.
Thanks, John. An overview of operational performance is shown on slide 15. I'm directing. I remember now. Excuse me. And firstly, in OH&S terms, we continue to achieve a relatively low rate of lost time injuries with a total of 6 incidents across the 41 wind farms that we manage across Australia, France, Germany and the US. A majority of these incidents have occurred on our wind farms under construction, which has highlighted our need to focus more in this area. However, we remain convinced that they are all avoidable, and we remain committed to an incident and injury-free culture. In terms of generation, as Miles mentioned earlier, we had increased output from our new and existing wind farms in Australia, France and Germany, offset by lowered US generation in the 6 months, resulting in generation for the entire period or business being slightly higher than the previous corresponding period. We maintained a healthy average price for our generation across the assets, particularly given that, as Gerard mentioned, we did not sell any of our renewable energy certificates created at Lake Bonnie 2, as we believe they are currently undervalued by a RET scheme that has fundamental structural flaws. The lower operational EBITDA margin of 64% reflects this decision not to sell RECs, the low wind conditions experienced in the US, as well as a strengthened US dollar. As mentioned in previous presentations with regards to our broader asset management and operational aspects of our business, we remain very focused on the transition to direct control of all operation and maintenance activities in order to improve availability and performance of our wind farms. I will provide a brief update in regards to progress in this area and early signs as to the benefit of these efforts. However, firstly, I'd like to provide further colour regarding performance of the individual countries. Starting with Australia on slide 16. In the six-month period, we increased our operational capacity to 469 megawatts and a corresponding increase in generation, reflecting Infigen's leadership position as a specialist renewable energy business in Australia. We were very happy to announce the commencement of operation of the Capital Wind Farm in New South Wales in October and look forward to an increasing contribution from the Capital Wind Farm as it ramps up to full availability. Availability across the existing assets in Australia improved significantly given an intensive effort to replace all of the failed gearboxes at Lake Bonnie 2, which was completed mid-December in time for the peak generation period over the summer. In price terms, the lower average price of $76 per megawatt hour reflects not selling the RECs created at Lake Bonnie 2 and weaker than expected wholesale market prices in the South Australian region of the NEM. I am pleased to advise that this has been offset by prices achieved in the early part of this calendar year. If we can now move to slide 17, performance in the US for the 6 months is profiled. In generation, our wind farms in the US experienced historically low wind conditions, which impacted the majority of our wind farms. Some of the wind speeds were up to 12% lower than the long-term average, keeping in mind that energy output, keeping in mind that energy output is proportional to a cube of the wind speed. Availability improved and was above budget across the majority of the US assets, largely due to the efforts of the very experienced and highly regarded asset management team running under the name of Blue Arc, who joined Infigen in June last year. The average market price achieved per megawatt hour of approximately $82, inclusive of the PTC, or production tax credit, remained relatively stable, reflecting the highly contracted nature of our US assets. The reduced EBITDA, operational EBITDA margin reflects this lower generation as well as a stronger Australian dollar relative to the US. Moving now to Germany on slide 18. Generation increased significantly as a result of additional capacity combined with much better wind speeds, in turn resulting in a much improved capacity factor of over 21%. Asset availability has consistently averaged over 97%. Each of these contributed to achieving an improved operational EBITDA margin of almost 75%. Moving now to France on slide 19. Generation also increased significantly as a result of additional capacity combined with much better wind speeds and excellent availability, in turn resulting in a much improved capacity factor of almost 25%. Each of these contributed to maintaining an operational margin of over 86%. On slide 20, we describe some of the progress made with our continued focus to our transition to direct control of our operational and maintenance activities. The aim of this move, as mentioned previously, is to align asset performance and risk management directly with asset ownership, improving availability and ultimately asset performance. The slide describes availability performance of two of our wind farms in the US, Cedar Creek and Sweetwater 1. At Cedar Creek, which we have described in previous presentations, we were able to take this approach from the commencement of operation in late 2007. As you can see, with direct control, the assets have been able to consistently achieve site availability above 98%. As a further demonstration of the benefits of this strategy, Sweetwater 1 indicates how the transition to direct control after the initial O&M service agreements roll-off can lead to an improvement in availability performance. The availability performance described here is typical for an asset managed and operated by an original equipment manufacturer. Reasonable performance immediately post-completion that falls off significantly with time. As expected, after taking control of O&M activities, in this case in early 2009, there is usually a period of similar performance before ramping up to significantly better performance. In the case of Sweetwater 1 shown here, an improvement of approximately 7%. I hasten to add that this is quicker turnaround than typically planned for, albeit very welcome. Both of these examples demonstrate there is a tangible benefit from this approach. The fundamental difference in approach relates to attacking what has historically been the causes of poor performance. Response times, effective troubleshooting, and part supply and supply chain management. These are all resolvable and relate directly to people, skills, motivation and alignment. While application of this approach may vary from wind farm to wind farm, the primary focus remains the same and seeks to address the cause of poor availability rather than a post-event cure. To give a feel for the benefit, 7% of availability on a relatively small asset such as Sweetwater 1 translates to approximately $1 million per annum in revenue. Very quickly on slide 21, an update in terms of construction. As mentioned earlier, in the first 6 months of financial year 10, we added the Capital Wind Farm of 140.7 megawatts, which became operational in October. We have one additional wind farm in the final stages of construction in Australia, which is the 39-megawatt Lake Bonney 3 wind farm in South Australia. As advised previously, we have experienced some delays in finalising the timing of connection for Lake Bonney 3. However, the turbines are progressing through their final reliability tests, and we expect the wind farm to be operational in April this year. I'll now hand back to Miles, who will go through the concluding slides.
Thanks, Jeff. Turning now to slide 23. Infogen owns the largest independent portfolio of wind farms in the United States that's not already owned by a utility. And we have small portfolios of assets in Germany and France. As I mentioned at the outset, we are proceeding on track to conclude our US and European sale processes, with all three processes now in the final binding bid stages. Given the late stage of those processes, we're keen to maintain competitive tension, and I do not propose to provide any further details. Turning now to slide 24, I've already commented on the status of the RET scheme and our current dialogue with government seeking to restore the effectiveness of the scheme to deliver on its primary objective. I'm encouraged by the government's acknowledgement of the need to fix this issue, but stress again the urgency of this requirement. On slide 25, we set out in more detail the current status of our project development pipeline in Australia. It's particularly pleasing that we now have in place an experienced development team and a high-quality pipeline of opportunities from which to source attractive investments for our business. Projects in the pipeline are progressing well, and we're positioned well to deliver initial projects from that pipeline this year, as advised previously. Finally, on slide 26, the outlook for Infogen is particularly strong as Australia's leading specialist renewable energy business and as the largest wind energy generator in the country. We're confident that the current review of the RET scheme will result in a restoration of the effectiveness of the scheme, and we are very well positioned to benefit from that fix. The financial year 10 result will be skewed toward the second half, as in prior periods, and we expect growth in Australian generation and revenue of around 25 to 40% in that period. As previously advised, distribution guidance for FY10 will be provided when the outcome of the sale processes is known. Now, that concludes the formal presentation. We'll now open the floor for questions and then subsequently for questions from the phone. Do I have any questions from the floor?
Hi, Miles. Brad Quillon from Credit Suisse. Just a quick question on your development strategy and how the current REC pricing environment plays into that, and if that will slow down making commitments on wind farms this year, post the sale process being completed. And just secondly, in terms of the buyback, can we expect to see any of the cash out of the sale process directed towards buyback in the second half of this calendar year? Thanks.
Thanks, Brad. On the first question, the bulk of our revenue from renewable energy certificates is, of course, contracted. It's over 70% of our revenue is contracted. So it's the uncontracted portion of the existing portfolio that's affected by REC prices and, of course, future projects. In the case of the uncontracted portion of the existing portfolio, we're talking about Lake Bonnie Stage 2, 160 megawatts. As Gerard and Jeff have described, we have banked the RECs from that project. We are fortunate to have the balance sheet strength and financial flexibility to be able to do that. So we believe the value of those RECs is substantially higher than recent spot prices, which have been in the sort of low 30s. In the year ended 30 June 09, we achieved average REC prices of around $48. So the immediate impact on us for the existing portfolio is one where we need to bank those RECs, so it's not a big impact. In terms of the portfolio of projects that we're developing, in the short term, again, we've said that we expect the first projects from that pipeline to commence this year, and we're still on track to do that. We have a build contract finance model that we've described before, so we're not immediately dependent on contracts in order to get our projects going. So in the short term, I'm talking 6 to 12 months, we don't expect that the current REC price situation and the status of the legislation will have any material impact on us. But where it's obviously important is the medium to long term, because we have 1,000 megawatts plus in our pipeline. We want to develop that pipeline. We've got both the sites, the people, the capital to do that. We think we can achieve very attractive returns. I guess if the REC scheme wasn't fixed for years, yes, that would be a material problem for us. But in terms of the current expected timing, the government has acknowledged that there is a problem with the REC scheme. They have instituted a review of that scheme, a COAG review. The government has indicated that they expect a March outcome of that review. But even allowing for, you know, even if it was delayed a bit, it's not going to have a material impact on our business now. But it's more the long-term impact on our business that we're concerned about. And we want the fix that's put in place now to be the right fix that's going to give us not only the right scheme, but it's going to give certainty to off-takers about what their obligations are going to be under the scheme, and therefore for them to consider what their obligations are and how they might satisfy those obligations. On the buyback, we have put in place the required notifications in relation to a buyback of up to 10% of the stock. That buyback can be undertaken without shareholder approval. You recall we previously had a specific approval for up to a 30% buyback. When that expired, we put in place the arrangements for the more normal 10% buyback in a 12-month period. We haven't acquired shares recently. As you'd be aware, one of the requirements under buyback schemes in Australia is you can't buy shares when the company itself has inside knowledge. And obviously with major sale processes running, that would be an issue. Once the sale processes are concluded, decisions about buyback versus new investment will be made on the same basis as previously. That is, if the share price is such that the return on buying our shares was as attractive as what we've indicated as being high teens IRRs on our development portfolio, then we'd consider it. Are there other questions from the floor? Well, I might ask if there's some questions on the phone.
Your first question comes from Hugh Morgan from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead, sir.
Oh, good afternoon, Miles. Appreciate the confidential nature of the divestment programs. Just wondering if you're able to give us any indication of potential timelines there.
Thanks, Hugh. We have previously given guidance that we expected to conclude the sale processes in the first quarter of this year, and we haven't changed that guidance. So we are on track. As I mentioned, we are in the final binding bid phase of all three processes. But I'm sure you understand the reason about sort of confidentiality. It's really about maintaining the competitive tension in those three processes. We have, as many of you will know, 12 to 18 months ago sold some significant portfolios in Portugal and Spain, and we had a similar issue there where we wanted to maintain very tight control on communications around the sale processes, particularly towards the end, in order to maximise the competitive tension in those processes. And we think we did that well in the case of both of those sales, and we're planning to take the same approach this time around.
Okay, thank you. Just a follow-up question then, I guess, in terms of the Australian pipeline and your plans to obviously commence development on one or more projects this year. Are those particular projects contingent on a successful outcome for the asset divestment program?
As I mentioned, we have substantial cash on hand at the moment. I guess the what we've indicated about the sale processes is it would enable us to accelerate the development of our pipeline. Obviously, given what I've stated about the status of those programs, those sale processes, we are in fact on track. But if for some unforeseen reason we did not proceed with sales, the impact would be a slower rate of growth in Australia for our development pipeline.
Thank you, Miles.
Your next question comes from Jenny Cosgrove from Wilson HTM. Please go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to explore the US result a little bit more, which was fairly weak. The first question is, of the US EBITDA at 37.5, are you able to put that on a constant currency basis to indicate to us how much of that reduction is due to FX? And then the second question relates to the movements in the items associated with the institutional equity partnerships. And the question is really, how much discretion, well, it's twofold. First, how much discretion do you have in the movements of those items to allow a positive net income of 13.1 to be reported in this period? And two, has the weak operational result influenced that 13.1 in any way?
Thanks, Jenny. I'll just ask you to repeat the remainder of the question after what discretion do we have. I didn't hear it. Thank you.
Okay. So the various in, movements in the institutional equity partnership items, and there's quite a number of them, how much discretion do you have in those various, in the amounts of those various movements? And second, is it... is one of the factors that the net income is positive at 13.1 from the IEPs a result of the weak operational results in the US assets? Was that clear?
Thanks, Jenny. Gerard, I might ask if you could answer those questions.
Sure. I'll answer the second question first. If I may, the institutional equity partnerships, there is no discretion on the movement in the balances. The balance is really a function of the number of PTCs that are generated in the period. It's also then impacted by the amount of tax deduction that we get for accelerated depreciation on the original asset. And then we apply a fixed return to the balance in order to calculate the movement during the period. So there's one other item, which is the value of the retained equity ownership of the tax equity, which occurs at the end of a flip point, which is generally speaking around 10 years after commencement of operations. And it's really that value which has deteriorated as a result of the operational performance in the period. So quick answer to your question, Jenny, is that yes, the operational performance has then dampened the effect on our profit and loss by actually making a net contribution from that institutional equity partnership compared to the reduction in EBITDA generated by revenue and costs.
The second part of the question was the impact, that part of the US EBITDA reduction that was associated with FX movements.
Yeah, I don't actually have that one to hand, Jenny. I think one thing I would be able to confirm is operational costs year on year are effectively stable. So the deterioration in the EBITDA that you're referring to is a function of the price reductions in the year, which I described in the presentation, about 5 million, and obviously the production variance of 8% down year on, or period on period. So operational costs remain stable, and revenues, on the other hand, have been down through price and production.
Okay, it just looks like EBITDA has fallen by a much larger amount than revenue. Okay, thank you.
Happy to come back to you, Jenny, but the numbers I just, or the calculations I just referred to are robust and explain the difference.
Once again, it's star one to ask your question. Your next question comes from Simon Chan from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. I actually had the same question as Jenny. I mean, your EBITDA margin seems to have fallen a lot more than, you know, what the fall in your revenue implies for the USA. But anyway, I'll move on from that. I'm just on slide 13 at the moment, and looking at your guidance for the next half. Now, back of the envelope calculation I've done now kind of implies that you're not expecting the second half to reach P50 either. Am I correct in that?
Simon, if you take a face value look, that's the impression you would get, but it's probably worth explaining the process that went into building up the... First of all, I'll talk about the production, or i.e. the volume, and then the revenue on the price side.
Yep.
On the production side, it's built up on a wind farm by wind farm basis.
Right.
It does take into account near-term events that we are aware of. For example, there is some downtime that will be associated with the connection of LB3, which will impact LB1 and LB2 for a number of weeks in the second half, so we take that into account. Also, when you're looking at the numbers for Australia, using that example to sort of do a direct comparison with the P50, you do need to keep in mind that we've got two assets newly constructed that are going through an availability ramp-up as they reach full operation. So there's distortions in the build-up on the production side on a wind farm by wind farm basis. So without going through each of the 41, you can imagine that sort of that's you have examples of that across the portfolio. On the price side, similarly, obviously with largely a higher contracted portfolio, we do spend extra time taking a view on market prices, where we do have market exposure, LB2 in Australia, LB3 coming forward, and also GSG, Mendota, and Sweetwater 4, in the US. I mixed those up. And of course, as Gerard and Miles have both highlighted, the REC price, we do take a view on that, and as we forecast in that guidance, is we don't expect to be selling any RECs created out of LB2 in the next 6 months. So there is a fair amount of details. I do take your point that at face value you can assume that you could take the read that we don't expect to achieve P50. We see that, yes, as being part of the guidance we've given for the next 6 months, but I would not take that as a long-term view.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jeff.
There are no further questions, sir. Please continue.
Do we have any other questions from the floor?
Just wait till you've got the microphone. That way the people on the phone can hear.
Maybe in the private investors take a different view of stocks to institutional investors. I'm not quite sure. But prior to the change in the way you're going to declare profits and pay dividends, and as I understand the last meeting you were going to pay on it, having a look at the profit and loss account rather than the cash flow, then I guess a number of people, me included, would be interested to know then, well, what sort of company do I own? Do I own a company with a reasonable yield or growth prospects or what? Now, I would have been a bit more specific, but I understand the situation in the US, so you can't talk about that, and that takes away a bit of the specifics of what you are going to do next. So perhaps I'll put it another way. It would be nice after you do that, rather than just giving a guidance on the dividend and things like that, is what's the raison d'etre of the company starting to look like? Because it is different, and I happen to agree with what you're doing, but it will show a different sign to the marketplace, I think, as to why people would own this stock or stocks like this. And there's plenty of competition after what's just happened in the world markets, where people start to say to themselves, well, look, if we can get a good return and reasonable growth instead of no return and who knows what, but hopefully good growth, we'll see it differently. So I'd actually urge you, dare I say it, to cover all those aspects, because whether it'll rejig the price for the people to look at wind prices and US dollars and heavens knows what else, and that's too many equations in my opinion for any person to cope with, then I think people are going to be interested. If it's going to be an Australian company with Australian assets, well, that takes one ingredient out, for heaven's sake, and I think then people can re-have a look at it. As far as buying back shares, I really do hope you leave that out of it until at their no-brain price. Because the other thing, it's just looking at profit and loss accounts, and that's what you've got to now do, if that's where you're going to pay the profits, and you've got a huge interest bill, and although you might have $200 million in the bank, you owe about plenty. And if I was asking the question, it would be, do you think you'll clear all your debt by selling the American assets? That's what I would have asked if I could have. Because I think that low debt and all those things that go with it make for attractive investments to the average, even semi-professional investor. So perhaps when you do get around to much, perhaps, and add one other thing if I may. I thought the word guidance to dividend took on a life of its own after the last meeting. Guidance means this is what we hope we'll do. In fact, it didn't mean that at all. It meant guidance meaning no dividend, and I think a lot of people, and I saw what the chairman said at the meeting, but I thought it stuck in between a couple of lines, because I doubt whether anyone asked you a question about it at the annual meeting, which I was not at. And so look, I think income and growth and where it fits in your plan is an important issue in my opinion in a company that's about this size. It's not the size of BHP, it's 1 point something billion.
Thanks very much, David. I appreciate your comments. A couple of comments I'd make in response. One is that clearly we have moved away from being what was a managed fund, and the managed fund concept typically was associated with a distribution policy that paid out the bulk, or in some cases, not us, more than the bulk of net operating cash flow. Our approach was that we thought that model wasn't any longer appropriate, and we separated from Babcock & Brown, as you know the history, to get away from that model in particular, and we certainly found it wasn't getting investor support at the time. I guess the situation now is we've moved to being a fully integrated renewable energy business. Unlike the past, where we had no internal growth prospect, we now have that growth prospect. We have a fantastic pipeline, which I've described. We've got a great development team. And we think we have opportunities to invest at high teens type equity returns. And I guess like a more normal company as opposed to a managed fund, we would expect that if we behave like a normal company, we would retain some of our net operating cash flow to reinvest in what look like very attractive projects for shareholders. Coming back to the actual distribution guidance, the point I think that the directors were making was that the distribution guidance would be provided when the outcome of the sale processes was known, because, as you mentioned, the impact of those sales processes is very substantial on the company. So the fact that we have not paid an interim distribution for the half shouldn't be taken as an indication that we're not intending to ever pay a distribution again, far from it. But I think the guidance that the board has been comfortable in giving is that in considering not only guidance for the FY10 distribution, but also distribution policy beyond FY10, the approach that will be taken will be one more of focusing on net operating profit, and then retaining some portion of that, yet to be determined, but some portion of that to reinvest in what we think are great growth opportunities.
Would you be prepared, or are you likely, comment on the proportion of profit you pay out of dividend? Is that one of the things you've
got in mind? I'll just repeat the question for the benefit of those on the phone. The question was, are we prepared to state what the proportion of our profitability would be that we would reinvest or pay out as distribution? That is a matter that certainly will be considered by the board, and the board has already, I think, given an indication that it intends to consider basing the future distribution policy on some measure of net operating profit. So I think you can interpret from that yes, some mechanism that looks at a proportion to be paid out from that is likely. It's just that the board has not formally considered what that policy would be and what that percentage might be.
and they've taken the view that really they need the information, which is what is the outcome of the sale processes before they make that decision. Are there any other questions on the floor? Well, we have no other questions on the phone, so thank you all very much for participating here today and also on the phone. As always, if you have any further questions, you can contact Rosalie Duff, our Head of Investor Relations. Thank you very much.